I'm John Kroll. There will be a buzz surrounding today's No Limits. We're going to talk about bees and the people who keep them. We're going to talk about the reasons maintaining a thriving bee population is important and about what it takes to keep one thriving. My guests will be Kate Fronsman, a local beekeeper and urban farmer, and George and Christine Plews, two Indianapolis lawyers who have invested in keeping bee populations thriving. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits at WFYI.org, Twitter is WFYI, Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about saving bees. If you would like to join the conversation, that's in not the letter B, but the flying insect. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are George and Christine Plews, two Indianapolis attorneys who've invested in keeping bee populations alive, and Kate Fronsman, who is a local beekeeper and urban farmer. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy
Thanks.
To be here.
Well, I'm going to start with Kate. Give me the overview here and give the audience the overview. Why is it important that we preserve bee populations?
Sure. Bees are inextricably linked to what we eat and how we get our food. We depend on bees for so many of the crops that we enjoy. Without bees and their pollination services, we wouldn't have apples, avocados, blueberries, even coffee and chocolate depend on bees. So it's sort of evident that if bees disappear off the face of the earth, and they're in big trouble right now, that we would not have food.
Well, could you talk a little bit about how that connection, why they are so important to those food sources?
Sure. So bees get their food from flowers, and crops that flower depend on pollination, which, so a bee is looking for food. It goes from flower to flower and not really knowing that it's somehow connected to what we eat, but it's getting its own food source. And as it goes from flower to flower collecting nectar, it pollinates and makes it able for crops to produce. Let's say there are no bees in an area, and this is actually true for some parts of the world. There are no bees, and so there are people with paintbrushes going from flower to flower, passing pollen, so that these flowers will pollinate and then produce the crops.
George, Christine, how did you become aware of this need, and how great is that need? I'll start with either one of you.
Well, we had seen a lecture by Dr. Douglas Ptolemy, who is a wildlife ecologist and entomologist from the University of Delaware. And he is the internationally known person advocating planting native plants, or plants that are endemic to a certain area, because of the need for insects to land on those plants and then to maintain the circle of life. All the little plants are timed to bloom at a certain time, and then the insects are timed to migrate to them at a certain time. Then the birds migrate to eat the insects, and the whole web of life is maintained that way. But if you knock out all the native plants and you just, for example, plant a big lawn of green grass and put pesticides on it, then you break the cycle. And bees are important as insects in maintaining how plants and flowers and trees reproduce. A lot of the bees in the United States are domestic bees that came from Europe, but there are also native bee populations, and it really doesn't matter, as Kate said, who does the pollinating. These European bees can do the pollination as well. And it looked, I mean, there's a potential for the collapse of all the chain of life if we don't maintain these insect populations. And so I guess that's why we originally knew about this insect chain. And one of my husband's partners, John Ketchum, had bees up in Carmel, and they weren't doing very well. And he saw our yard that was planted all in native plants and flowers and forbs and grasses and trees. And he said, oh, my bees would be so happy here. So he moved his hive down to our house. And when he later had an accident, we had to learn how to take care of these bees. And we went to a class given by the Indiana Beekeepers Association that we signed up for at the state fair in that building that's the agricultural building at the fair, and it was extremely entertaining. It was like going to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, because there was such a broad cross-section of Indiana society who were interested in bees, and it was very educational, and we learned the things that Kate was saying and how to actually maintain a hive and take care of these bees and help them along.
How long ago was this, George?
Probably about a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Okay, so it's a relatively recent enthusiasm.
Well, Chris has been very enthusiastic, I have too, about native plants, and that sort of grew from that. We discovered to John Ketchum that the number one enemy of bees actually is teenage boys. They get
they're the enemy of so many things.
They inevitably get too fascinated by the hive, and a dare leads to somebody trying to go touch a hive, and then the hive gets knocked over. And so our property has a ravine on both sides and borders the White River, so it has plenty of water. We had all these flowers, and so it was a perfect environment for a beehive.
We are talking about saving bees here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Kate, other than teenage boys, what are the things that are threatening bees? I mean, we're actually, the numbers are pretty daunting.
Incredible. Yeah, it's incredible.
Can you put it, first, I guess, before we get to the threats, can you talk about, you know, where we are in terms of the bee population now as opposed to, you know, a generation ago?
We've decreased our bee population by about half since 1940, 1950. The numbers are incredible to look at. Colony collapse disorder is something that's been making headlines. In about 2006, beekeepers, commercial beekeepers especially, started sounding the alarm that something is really wrong with bees. So colony collapse disorder is basically the bees in a hive disappear. They are not even, you know, dead outside on the ground. They just disappear, and they leave behind their food supply or their babies or their queen, which is sort of completely not what you think a bee would do at all. And so it was, for a long time, researchers couldn't explain exactly what was happening to bees. But now we are just starting to find out. Harvard actually released a study on Monday saying that these pesticides, these systemic pesticides that are in the seed when the crops go in the ground, our agricultural practices, really, in the U.S., are pretty terrible for bees. There's a lot of monoculture, which means just acres and acres of corn or soybeans. So all these, it's a confluence of all these factors that sort of contribute to the decline of bees.
And you're saying that in a space of about 60, maybe 70 years, the bee population has been cut in half.
And this winter especially was bad. The weather was bad, but also these factors contribute to a weakened immune system in the bees, and they're more susceptible to mites or other viruses that can wipe out an entire hive. So here in the Midwest, the number was an 80% die-off rate for all colonies, which is, that's only 20% survival rate, and that's huge.
So what can we do about this? Toss it to George, I guess. Since,
well, I think all the things that affect bees, we can act on those. We can act on increasing the number of flowering plants we have to make the food source available, providing more better habitats, being more careful about pesticide practices and herbicide practices. I think the UK has recently banned use of certain kinds of pesticides in order to protect their honeybee population. We can propagate, I think also provide colonies for them, provide spaces for them in urban areas like here on the roof of WFYI or, mm-hmm. or at other places. So those are the important things you can do, I think. It is important to note that bees are sensitive, really sensitive creatures, irrespective of all environmental and other insults. The die-off rate is fairly high, and they need to be reproducing and replaced fairly frequently.
What is the lifespan for a bee?
During the summer when they're collecting nectar, they'll wear themselves out so quickly they might live 20, 25 days. And then over the winter, they survive longer because they're in the hive eating all that honey that they've been building up a store of over the summer.
So you're talking about less than a month in an active, and in the period when we tend to see them around, right, and all of that. Are any of these efforts, I mean, we've talked about a pretty precipitous rate of decline here in terms of the bee populations. Are any of these efforts, you know, making headway, or are we at least seeing the rate of disappearance slow at all, Christine? Or?
Well, right now, as Corky said, the European Union acted fairly quickly and banned neonicotinoids, which are the pesticides that are being suspected of wiping out the bee populations. But we're still selling them in the United States. You can buy them in any big box hardware store. And there's a movement afoot right now to get some of the big box stores to stop carrying these pesticides because of what's happening to bees. And I don't know whether the United States will act as quickly as Europe did. Agricultural practices also have changed, and those may be more slow to adapt because traditionally farmers would leave hedgerows, especially in Europe and the United States, of trees and plants along the edges of their farms. But with intense agriculture, crops are going from lot line to lot line. And these little corridors where wildlife used to be able to live and flourish are not there anymore. So it isn't just a one pronged thing. I mean, we can ban the neonicotinoids, and that might that might help. But even green lawns, which most people think are very pretty, and they are really nice and lush, and you can lie on them, they're actually really bad for nature and for ecology because it's a monoculture, and because there's no variety of life, and because in order to maintain that kind of a lawn, you have to put pesticides and fertilizers on it to keep it looking good. An interesting thing happened in China a long time ago when Chairman Mao was in power. He had the theory that the sparrows were eating too much of the people's grain, and so he had all sparrows eliminated, and what this also did was kill all the insects as well. Mm-hmm. And now in China, they have to, as Kate was saying, pollinate by hand. And this is a really amazing thing, and only if you have a population that they have in China can you carry this out. But they have human beings climbing up in trees with little brushes, individually pollinating each flower on flowering trees, and their whole agriculture depends on this human being.
We are talking about bees here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I had a caller who didn't want to go on the air, had a question, said, did the killer bee scare make people overreact and kill bees out of fear? Kate, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, we hear about killer bees and Africanized bees, and it sort of sounds rather sci-fi that they escaped from a science experiment and made their way up. And there's actually a really great documentary out right now called More Than Honey, where they sort of explore this a little bit. And they're actually finding that these Africanized bees, though they might be slightly more aggressive than the European honeybee that were used to, they actually are much hardier and might be the answer to the bee's survival. The honeybees are the best, by far the best pollinators because of the way their mini society works. So it's a way to make them more resistant to all these factors that are killing them off would be great.
So the killer bees actually might be a solution to the problem.
It could be.
And the one that we freaked out about is the one that might offer some
right.
some hope. Now, how long is a difference of lifespan? Do they live longer?
You know, or? I'm not sure, but I also know, you know, we think of these killer bees, Africanized bees, coming, you know, in a big swarm and sort of descending upon a person. But if I one thing I want to say is if you ever see a swarm of bees, almost guarantee that those bees are probably the calmest set of bees that you'll ever see, because bees, and this is going to happen here in May and June, bees, when they swarm, they're just looking for a new home. There's the colony splits in two, and half of them go off to find a new home, and they've just eaten a bunch of honey, and their queen is in the center. They're not protecting a hive, so they're very calm. And in fact, last year I captured two swarms of bees and put them in hives, and then put those hives on different urban farms around town. But they let me just scoop them up with my hands, and I didn't get stung.
We are talking about saving bees here on No Limits. My guests are local attorneys George and Christine Plews and urban farmer and local beekeeper Kate Fronsman. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about saving bees here on No Limits. My guests are George and Christine Plews, two Indianapolis attorneys who have sponsored hives in Washington, D.C. and here, and Kate Fronsman, who's a local beekeeper and urban farmer. Gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. It says, why can't children under the age of one consume honey? Kate?
It's because of the properties of honey. There are certain enzymes and antibacterial properties. And, you know, I don't know a lot about honey and all of its, I mean, it's got many miraculous properties, but it's sort of within the hive there are you know, bacteria and things that form, and the bees are really good at getting all of that off, and they process it through the honey, and the honey itself is antibacterial. But some of that material can be in the honey when it's harvested, and young children can't always defend themselves against that because they're little.
Go ahead, Christine.
I was going to say there's some other interesting properties of honey that Kate just touched on. In the Egyptian tombs, there's honey, which is mm-hmm. still edible. And Alexander the
Without
Great.
Without preservatives.
Right. I mean, it has its own preservative properties.
It never spoils.
And Alexander the Great was preserved in his body, was preserved in honey. So ancient peoples have known about honey for a very long time and the special things that it
And the
does.
Things that it can do.
Right.
I want to ask, Kate, you in particular, we've got a little bit of the backstory on how George and Christine got involved in all of this. How did you set out to become urban farmer, beekeeper? I mean, what brought you to this moment in your life?
I actually used to work in advertising for a number of years. Had a fairly lucrative career and became.
You're speaking in past tense.
No, I became very interested in urban agriculture, well, agriculture in general, and, you know, this urban homesteading phenomenon is really taking over Indianapolis. And the more I became interested, the more I thought maybe I'd be better suited, you know, for the life bucolic and not inside at a desk all day. I want to be outside. And so I got really interested in beekeeping. I started this project called Bee Public, keeping hives at urban farms in downtown Indianapolis, and also just raising awareness about the decline of honeybees and pollinators in general and why they're so important to us. And so at the same time, I sort of left that life behind and took up urban farming and immediately saw that bees and agriculture were intertwined and took off from there.
What goes into, you know, if you decide you want to become a beekeeper, and I'm asking this question completely mm-hmm. out of ignorance. I'll start. Any one of you, you know, how do you start? What do you begin with? And I'll ask a question that everybody out there is thinking but is afraid to mm-hmm. ask. How do you avoid getting stung over and over again?
Well, I can tell you I've been doing this for a couple years and have had maybe 8 or 9 hives, and I've been stung a few times, but only a handful, and it's always my fault. Bees don't want to sting you because bees know when they sting you, they die. Their stinger actually has vital organs attached to it. If you've ever been stung, you know the stinger stays behind, and when it detaches, they die immediately. So they're very conservative with their stinging.
I think a lot of people get wasps, especially ground wasps, confused with bees. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that are really aggressive and will come out and sting you, and a lot of people call those bees, and they're really wasps. And honeybees, as Kate said, really don't want to sting you, and they're disemboweled if they do. So they really save that.
They're very gentle.
And they leave you alone. They stay in their hive. They go about and do their business. When they fly out, they go and go up and out and look for flowers. They're really not interested in humans. They're not aggressive.
So what do you need to get started then? I asked the stinging question. Here, I got that one out of the way.
Important.
But what do you do to...
I can tell you how I got started. I read a bunch of books and I watched a bunch of YouTube videos and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm never going to be ready to do this. But then at some point you just jump in. So you buy a hive. There are a few different hive types that you can choose from. You just need about 5 by 5 foot square space to put the hive in. They don't need a lot of space around the hive. They'll fly up and over a fence if there's a fence. They'll go up to 3 miles to find food. So you don't necessarily have to have a garden right outside the hive. You just need a sunny spot to put a hive, and you can purchase bees from a local beekeeper. You can actually order bees in the mail if you choose to do that, and your post office will call you in a panic, and you go pick up your bees. But you can order a package of bees, and it's kind of unceremonious the way you install a package. You open up the hive and dump them in and then close the lid and then hope that, you know, sort of pray that they stay. And that's what beekeeping is. You know, as much as we talk about we've domesticated bees, we actually just kind of ask them politely, will you stay here? I made you a home, please.
Yeah, you've got a nice house and it would be wrong to leave. We are talking about saving bees here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Or you can do what this listener has done, shoot us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Question is there a way to convince municipalities to not spray for mosquitoes so as to preserve the rest of the pollinators and beneficial insects? I'm seeing Kate nodding her head.
I lost a hive to a mosquito spray truck last year around the time the state fair was rolling in because they go nuts that time of year. And you can supposedly put yourself on a no spray list, which I was. And if the truck goes down an alley, which this hive was near an alley, they're spraying the house across the alley. The wind could pick up the spray and kill a hive. And they died within a day, all of them dead inside the hive. So I think the biggest thing we can do, and this goes with the general public as well, is just increasing awareness. And, you know, if you see bees, and especially in the big ball of bees that is a swarm, don't call an exterminator. Don't spray them with pesticides. Call a beekeeper. They'll come and get them for you.
Yeah, it's a profit opportunity for you guys.
Yeah. Give them a good home.
George.
Beekeepers, they fantasize about finding a wild swarm, actually. We had a swarm move into one of our hives, and it was like that's a celebratory event that is very rare and to be marveled at, not dreaded.
Also, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources has a list of beekeepers. Mm-hmm. So if a person sees a swarm, they can call any one of these beekeepers on the list that will come and get it. And I've actually talked to people who've had this happen, and they regard it as kind of a miraculous event. Mm-hmm. They see these swarms, they find a beekeeper, comes and get them, and it makes them all feel very friendly toward the situation.
And I wanted to follow on something Kate said that was very, very important, and that is that bees travel. They don't congregate around the hive. They're busy. They've got work to do. They go up in the air about 12 or 15 feet above the hive. We actually have our hive off the end of a basketball court, which has some screening from some bushes and things.
Okay.
But so, when our son, when we first brought the beehive home and showed him where it was going to be, and we were all excited, and he said to us very, very seriously, "That's the stupidest thing I've ever done." but it really was worked out fine. The bees go straight up in the air, and then they go to wherever the food sources are off your property up to about 3 miles range. So as long as you've got we haven't noticed there have been no problems with having bees on our property. It's been very delightful.
We are talking about saving bees here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Lloyd, welcome to the program.
Yes, am I on the air?
You are indeed. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you very much. I enjoy your program, and I am enjoying this one very much.
Thank you.
I heard the answer given a bit ago to the question about why children under the age of one shouldn't eat honey.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the answer could be potentially insufficient and maybe dangerously so. And the reason I think that is because I don't think bacteria necessarily is a big concern. I think the bigger concern is that honey can contain botulism spores. And botulism spores aren't necessarily a problem for adults because the acidic environment of the stomach will kill the botulism spores. But that's not necessarily true for very young children. I think maybe that's a more complete and possibly safer answer.
You sound like you've got some medical training there, Lloyd. That's above my pay grade, that's for sure.
Okay, I just wanted to make that clear because if somebody thought it was bacteria only, maybe they would heat the honey to kill the bacteria. That would not necessarily kill the botulism spores.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the call and the clarification, Lloyd. Really appreciate it.
There's another little medical aspect of all this is that some people are told by their allergists that they need to eat local honey that will help them with their allergies, and it seems to work. So I've seen people also looking about saying, where can I find local honey? And I don't want to buy any of the stuff in the grocery store that comes from a national, or sometimes those are international sources. But there are a lot of sources in Indiana for local honey at farmers' markets and grocery stores.
There's another benefit to beekeeping that I wanted to mention, and that is that they are fascinating creatures to watch work.
Yeah.
The organizations of our society, I mean, philosophers since Plato and on through Karl Marx have always looked at bees and tried to see a model for human society. And there's a wonderful documentary that Kate mentioned I want to mention again called More Than Honey, which is out currently. People should see that. It is a terrific story.
It's on Netflix.
Netflix. And it tells about different beekeeping practices around the world, the history of beekeeping. It's truly a very educational and lays out a lot of the issues we're facing now with bees.
Yeah.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Misty, and if you would like to ask a question by email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Misty's question is, I am interested in beekeeping. How do you know when to harvest the honey?
Oh, that's a great question. So if you become
Practical one, too.
Yeah, if you become a beekeeper, don't think you're going to get a lot of honey right away. You actually cannot really harvest the honey the first year of beekeeping. Bees spend their entire summer building up the supply of honey, and that's their food. That's for them, and they know how much they need. So they produce this honey inside the hive, and they need it to survive the winter. And as a beekeeper, if you take that away from them, even if you're supplementing them with some sugar water, it's not enough. It doesn't have the nutrients. The pollen is their protein, and the nectar is their carbohydrates, and they need the honey to survive the winter. And then the next year, they'll build enough of a surplus that if you so choose, you can harvest the honey.
So is that when, I'm going to go back to the stupid question I asked earlier about being stung, when you said it is your fault, it sounds like they're like most other living creatures, that if you threaten something that is essential to them, that's when they will respond.
If the bee feels threatened, or if you happen to accidentally smack them or step on them or something like that, that's when you probably are going to get stung. I reached in and grabbed the lid off a hive, and there was a bee right underneath, and it stung my finger. But that was me not checking first.
We've gotten another email question from a listener. I think was paying attention, obviously, to Christine when she was talking about Egypt. Said. This is from Jerry. He says, was not honey used for medicinal purposes, too, by the ancient Egyptians?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's antibacterial. I actually put it on cuts and scrapes and things, and it really does help them heal faster and not get infected. It is miraculous. And you do have to make sure that you're getting raw honey that's not been heated, so the enzymes die off if it's heated too much. And you can get it at local farmers markets, Pokes Run Grocer, New Day Meadery, Good Earth, all have local honey from local beekeepers, which is so important when we're talking about saving bees, supporting your local beekeepers and local organic farmers who aren't using any kind of chemicals that could harm bees.
So how much honey do you produce then? During, or do your bees, I guess, more appropriately, you help them. But how?
My bees can produce, a healthy hive can produce 1,000 pounds of honey in a year. A lot of it they're eating and burning off quite quickly because they're so industrious. But they'll do a surplus. In the hive, they might have 80 pounds of honey inside the hive to survive the winter, 80 to 100. And then the next year, you as a beekeeper, you see the hive with the stacks of boxes. Mm-hmm. That's called a Langstroth hive. And so maybe the first year, they only get big enough that I've got 2 or 3 boxes. They fill all that up with babies and honey. Mm-hmm. And then I put a queen excluder. She's a little bit fatter, so she can't fit through the screen that I put on top of one of the boxes, but all her worker bees can, and so they make honey up top and she stays down below, creating the brood, the baby bees.
Gotten another question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. Do city codes allow for beekeeping in our urban areas?
Yes,
they do. Are there changes in public policy that would make, though, taking care of bees and preserving them better? Obviously, we've talked about the pesticide thing,
right.
But are there other things that, in terms of changing the way we do public business, that would make it easier? George, I'll start with you on
certainly
that.
Encouraging people to have alternatives to lawns, to have growing spaces where they would have flowering plants and flowers and things that would be that would encourage bees. That provides their food source for them. Mm-hmm. Also, very beautiful.
Yeah. Make it easier for urban farms to exist. I work for Growing Places Indy. We have several urban farms around downtown, and we're very conscious about pollinators. We plant in the rows. We plant clover, which attracts pollinators. And then when we aren't using a bed, we put in a cover crop, which is also flowering and providing food for bees. And we're planting things that bloom in the spring, in the summer, and the fall, which is very important for a bee's food supply.
Yeah, I was going to say you don't have to harvest the honey for the bee hive to continue to exist.
That's right.
And if you don't, I mean, it's a surefire way not to get stung.
It's not to harvest the honey and stay away. We've gotten a couple of questions. One of them is, what happens when the queen dies?
Oh, I have a great question. Because it sounds a little like the Hunger Games. But so a queen, if she dies, the hive will raise a new queen. And I discovered this the first time a queen didn't make it through the first few weeks of putting them in the hive. There are these little cells that pop up that kind of look like wax fingers. And they're queen cells. And so the hive is creating several virgin queens within the hive, and if one of them hatches before the other, she will actually, a queen can sting more than once, unlike her worker bees. And drones, the male bees actually don't have stingers. So the virgin queen hatches and she will sting through the other queen cells and kill the other virgin queen so that she can be the queen. Or if they happen to hatch at the same time, they will battle each other until one is a survivor. And then the virgin queen will take one flight outside the hive her entire life. She will mate with 10, 15 drones from other hives, come back and lay eggs the rest of her life, which might be about 3 years.
She lives longer than the
mother
bees.
Of all the bees in the hive.
So, are there ever instances then where one of the potential virgin queens somehow escapes
she might just fly away.
And what happens? And what happens in that? Because it sounds almost kind of Hunger Games.
It does.
Here and that, you know, that there is a real nature reddened tooth mm-hmm. and claw. Aspect to this, you know, what happens in those instances if you do have two queens mm-hmm. and one of them either escapes or
Yeah, they might raise five or six, maybe more, depending on the size of the hive. And then if they lose another queen, they know, they can sense it, they can smell it. She releases chemicals, and that's why, you know, when you get a package of bees, if you've ever seen one, the queen is in her own queen cage, separated, because they have not yet acclimated to her scent. And if she were released immediately, they'd kill her, because they haven't accepted her as their queen. So the bees know. If there is no queen, they will raise their own.
We are talking about saving bees here on No Limits. My guests are George and Christine Plews and Kate Fronsman. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about saving bees today on No Limits. My guests are George and Christine Plews, who have two local Indianapolis attorneys who have invested in keeping bee populations alive, and Kate Fronsman, who's a local beekeeper and urban farmer. We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Shannon. If you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. It says, if you don't want your own hive, what sort of plants should you have to support them and other pollinators?
Good question.
Christine.
Well, the best thing for all of the environment is to plant native plants. And they are very beautiful trees, flowers, grasses, shrubs. That support not only bees, but birds and other insects and wildlife. And those can be very attractively used for landscaping. Instead of planting, say, a marigold or a Bradford pear, you could plant a flowering Indiana plant. And they're readily available in garden stores. And the big stores are now advertising which trees and shrubs and flowers are native, and the Indianapolis Museum of Art has a collection of native plants, and the Indiana Native Plant and Wildflower Society has an annual auction and sale where people can buy these plants. So, and they're available online as well. There's a number of nurseries that specialize in native plants, and you can do the very same things you would do in landscaping a suburban land garden with and lawn, but use natives.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Pat. If you want to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. She says, or he, it could be, I guess it's one of them, I don't really have a good place for a hive. Is there any benefit to bee bug hotels, structures that house solitary bees but have no honey collecting structure?
Yeah. Solitary bees are really interesting. They can live alone, as that might suggest, or they could live sort of alone together, like in an apartment complex or like a structure like Pat was talking about. You can get, actually, speaking of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, in their greenhouse, they sell these solitary bee little houses, or you can make your own. The bumblebees and other solitary bees benefit just as much. There's a mutual benefit to planting native flowers that attract them. The basil plants every year have huge bumblebees just hanging out on them constantly.
We're talking about saving bees here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. James, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Great. I'm well, thanks. I'm enjoying the show. I wanted to ask about some of the uses of some of the other products that bees make, like bee pollen and royal jelly, how you use that, what it's good for. And I just would like to have more information about that.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Mm-hmm. Well, who would like to take that one? Kate?
Oh, yeah, I can talk about that. Bee pollen is a great supplement, and it's got a lot of protein in it. Again, it can help with allergies if you're getting it from local. You know, you want it to be local because that is the pollen that you are up against. Also, propolis is another thing, a product that can come out of a hive. It is it's the very sticky substance that bees use as kind of a super glue to secure everything together. It's dark brown. You see it in some toothpaste and oral health products. I've seen beekeepers just sort of pull it out of the hive. It looks kind of like silly putty, like dark brown silly putty. Just pop it in their mouth like chewing tobacco. It's really good for antibacterial properties as well. And it's basically sort of like the sap from plants that the bees are collecting and then turning into this sticky substance.
We're getting a lot of calls, email questions, and all of that. So I'm going to ask both our listeners who are calling in and the panel, let's try to keep the answers tight so we can get to as many mm-hmm. questions and the questions tight as well. Got one from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, wants the panel to discuss the Protect the Pollinators Act, and wants to ask more about the science behind pesticides and the relation it has with the decline of bees. Also, what should the legislation do? Why don't we start with what the legislation should do?
Well, I think we're seeing some things that are happening over in Europe that maybe if we mirror here, that would be the first step. But really, they've just recently admitted that the neonicotinoid pesticides are to blame for colony collapse disorder. I think that's the first step. It, for so long, for so many years, we said, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. Now we kind of know, let's do something about it.
We are talking.
There are also some bee pests, I guess you call it, or some problems that have been with bee populations that are not pesticide caused.
Other than teenage birds.
Varroa mites.
Right. Yeah. And so there are a variety of different things that need to be addressed, not just one. But
we are talking about saving bees here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'd like to get a plug in for two state organizations. We have the Indiana Beekeepers Association, and we have the Indiana State Beekeepers Association. And I'm a director right now in the IBA and a past president of that organization. And we have monthly meetings all around the state here where the different districts are meeting. And the people wanting to keep bees is just busting out. So we meet once a month. They can go online to like the IBA and see when those different meetings are being held. I'm an old-time beekeeper, kept bees for over 40 years, and so we're getting a lot of new members in, and we try to get them mentored up with old-time beekeepers, so if they got questions and they can go learn about bees and what's the mentor do things. So it's just busting. At our Indiana Bee School in February, we had the 12th one, and we had over 900 participants in that bee school this year, so it's people wanting to keep bees. It just seems to be busting more and more.
Is there a URL that people can go to get more information on either of the associations?
Online, you can go to Indiana Beekeepers Association. It's indianabeekeeper.com.
Okay.
And for the ISBA, you can just, I can't remember exactly what their one is, but I've been a member the ISBA was formed like in 1860 or something, and then the IBA are just here more recently in 1998. And so, but you can go online and go Indiana State Beekeepers Association, and it'll clip you to their website also.
We've also so gotten
lots of information out there, and a lot of people, the beekeepers are very, we always say if you ask four beekeepers the same question, you could probably get five different answers. Mm-hmm. So
that's
there's
true.
A lot of different ways to keep bees and everything. And so it's just busting right now.
Yeah, and we've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Ann who says that the Indiana Beekeeping School will have classes on beekeeping during two weekends in June as well. And the URL she offered was indianabeekeeping.com. Thanks very much for the call. And the
John, also the State Fair has an outstanding program that runs continuously throughout the fair, acquainting people with bees and beekeeping. So I'd recommend that to people who want to find out more.
So in August. So there are plenty of opportunities to do this and to find these services. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Erica who says, about how much can a new beekeeper expect to spend on hive supplies and other necessities? Sounds like we've got someone who's about to take the plunge.
Well, you know, it can be, I'm pretty frugal, so I sort of don't buy all the little contraptions and things that you could if you really wanted to, you know, get a big catalog and pick out all these things that can help you with your beekeeping. But if you're getting, let's say, a top bar hive, which is sort of the long, narrow hive that sits on a table, it's sort of the more natural approach to beekeeping, or a Langstroth hive, as I talked about earlier, it can be anywhere, depending on if you can make it yourself or who you get it from. I recommend getting a new hive and not a used one, because it could contain some sort of fungus or things that could be passed on to new bees. Anywhere from $100 to $150 for just the hive. And then, of course, you need safety equipment, a jacket or a veil or something that might cost, you know, $50, $75. It all depends on what kind of bells and whistles that you prefer. You'll need a hive tool. Those are pretty inexpensive. I put my hive up on cinder blocks, and I didn't get some fancy hive stand for it. Also, you'll need things like a bee brush and other little bits and pieces. But altogether, maybe you're spending on one hive $300 if you're pretty conservative.
And then buy the bees themselves.
And then the bees themselves,
How much do the bees cost?
Could find a swarm, which is free. Or from a local source, you're probably going to spend between $125, $150, depending on if you get a package of bees, which is about a three-pound box of bees, and that includes the queen. Or if you get what's called a nucleus hive, or a nuke, that is a hive that's gotten a little bit more of a start than the package, and it's actually has drawn out comb on a few frames that you can put into your hives. The bees have some honey to start with.
We are talking about saving bees here on No Limits. Kimberly, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm curious about wood bees or carpenter bees. We have some in our deck and our swing set, and I find them a nuisance and want to get rid of them, but my husband says, no, all bees are wonderful and we need to keep them in the yard. Can you tell me, are they beneficial? What's their story?
Yes, they
Thanks
are.
Thanks very much for the call, Kimberly.
They're very beneficial, and I agree with your husband.
In what ways are they beneficial?
They're great pollinators. You know, any bees, especially native bees, butterflies and birds and bats are all great pollinators, and they're also all suffering from all these factors that we've been mentioning. I always tell people, if you can, even wasps and hornets, which can sometimes be kind of jerks, they're a little more aggressive and they can sting you more than once. If you can, please leave them be, because they are doing a service to everybody.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Kevin, who says, this is a cool conversation. Kevin likes listening to you folks. I live in the city. Backyard is less than a half acre. Have a 20 by 20 basketball court. Could I have a bee farm? I do spread fertilizer for weeds. Would I have to stop?
It depends on the fertilizer, I guess. If it's synthetic, what you can do, too, is if there's something that you feel is necessary, or your neighbors feel is necessary and they're spraying on their lawns or their farms, maybe your next door neighbor is a farmer who's using unsustainable practices, you can cover the hive during that period of time and the bees will be fine. If you have a sprinkler going, the bees will assume it's raining and stay inside. also, bees go inside their hive at nighttime. So if you're spreading something that you think might be dangerous to bees, or someone else is, and you're downwind, you can do that at night.
Okay. Most of them are in the hive at night.
Mm-hmm. Think of roof space, too. I mean, WFYI is going to have beehives here on the green roof, and the NPR building in Washington has hives on its roof. So the green roof movement is really an important way to spread bees as well.
Got a caller who didn't want to go on the air. Says, has bees that are underground in her backyard and is worried about being stung or the family dog getting stung. What should she do?
So, again, if you can, leave them be. If you feel like they're threatening or someone's allergic, I completely understand. Dogs are pretty good about bees. They kind of know that that's not something they should mess with or agitate. But you can, with a lot of bees that maybe nest inside in the ground, or if they nest inside your home or in a wall or something, you can call a beekeeper and they will move them for you, or you could try to do it yourself. Bees are pretty gentle, and if you're doing something like that, you know, probably get some advice first and maybe go borrow a bee suit from a beekeeper.
There's also non-toxic sprays if you're really desperate, and there are ground wasps and they're stinging your children over and over, mm-hmm. That are made based on mint, and it works naturally to kill them in their underground nest, and it's not harmful to the environment or to other creatures, just that one focused little spot.
Right, and if they're coming back every year, if they're not there right now, flood the area, and they won't want to nest there.
Yes, that's another good alternative.
We've gotten a question or suggestion from a listener named Joanne via Facebook, and if you want to do that, you can connect with us at No Limits WFYI on Facebook. It says, talk about bee fidelity and why people should plant flowers in clumps or clusters of the same species instead of planting onesies throughout the yard. Consider also talking about caution when using fungicides, particularly deadly to bees, reducing or eliminating the use of all pesticides.
That's such a good question. So bees are pretty, well, actually plants are pretty smart, right? Plants are the ones that are running the show here. They're saying, I have this wonderful sweet food for you. Please come, take a stop, and then go on to the next one. And bees will actually visit the same type of flower over and over and over again until they've completed visiting all of that flower. So if you've got squash blossoms, they're going to visit all those squash blossoms first before they move on to another type of flower. And that's why pollination is so successful with honeybees, because they're pollinating one type of crop or flower before they move on to the next one. And fungicides, although they're not specifically to spray on bugs to kill bugs, the fungicides are harmful to bees. They mess with their neurological systems. They can kill, same thing with herbicides. You're killing bee food, so that is also detrimental to the bees.
We've got just a little bit of time. We're going to try to squeeze in one last question from Kara, sent it via Facebook. Says, isn't the local honey helping with allergies a total myth? After all, bees collect heavy, sticky pollen grains, but people are allergic to the light pollen grains, which travel more in the air. I have yet to find any legitimate science beyond alternative health advocates. Mm. Anyone know or can speak to?
I can just speak from personal experience. It does, for me, help. It's sort of building up. As I understand it, you build up a little bit of an immunity over time to the local pollen.
So let me ask it as sort of a last question. I'm going to give each of you about 10 seconds. What's the best thing? You're all passionate about this. What's the best thing about working with bees? George, I'll start with you.
Oh, boy. I think it's the – I'm fascinated with how hard they work, how well they work together, and the wonderful sweet results they produce.
So the opposite of Congress in every way.
I think that's part of it. Their society is really fascinating. They're highly organized. They're very intelligent. Someone, a man named Carl von Frisch, won the Nobel Prize for describing how they communicate to each other on where the pollen
they
is. They dance. They do the little waggle dance. And they're so good as part of showing how much of our language, in fact, comes from beekeeping and the bees and what goes on in the hive. They're just a really good example of cooperation and working together.
Kate, I think we'll have to have you back so you can have the last word on that subject. I'd like to thank my guests, George and Christine Plews and Kate Fronsman, for a fascinating hour. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.